Gaetz, the biggest firebrand inside of the House of Representatives.
You're not taking Matt Gaetz off the board, okay? Because Matt Gaetz is an American patriot and Matt Gaetz is an American hero.
We will not continue to allow the Uniparty to run this town without a fight.
I want to thank you, Matt Gaetz, for holding the line.
Matt Gaetz is a courageous man. If we had hundreds of Matt Gaetz in D.C., the country turns around. It's that simple.
He's so tough. He's so strong. He's smart, and he loves this country. Matt Gaetz.
It is the honor of my life to fight alongside each and every one of you. We will save America. It's Choose Your Fighter time. Send in the firebrands.
And this bill today funds all of that, continues to fund all of that. Every single Republican should vote no, and should be ashamed of ever voting yes. This is our opportunity. This is the time. Remember, this was supposed to be done last September. We're now in the middle of March of the next year. This is their opportunity to say what happened on the border yesterday that all of America is now looking at as they wake up this morning. This is going to stop, and it's going to stop with us. And if they don't vote no on this bill, what they're saying to their constituents, their bosses who sent them to Washington, D.C., Democrat or Republican, what you saw at the border, that's fine with me. That's good. Let's get more of that. I urge all of our colleagues, not just the brave ones that are standing here today in front of you, but every single member of the House, Republican and Democrat, reject this bill.
That was Congressman Scott Perry. We are live here in Room 2021 of the Rayburn House Office Building on the Capitol Complex in Washington, D.C., where the very shame that Scott Perry described played out as the House of Representatives passed the second half of the omnibus spending legislation today that we've worked so hard to try to stop. At the end, there were 286 yes votes, 134 no votes, so an overwhelming more than two-thirds majority for this terrible piece of legislation. We're going to go through some of the bad earmarks in it, some of the bad funding choices that were made. We always like to look at where the Republicans stood. And you heard Scott Perry there, a leader in the Freedom Caucus, calling out Republicans who would vote for this Democrat spending bill. 101 Republicans shamefully voted yes, 112 Republicans voted no. So that means a majority of the majority voted against this terrible legislation, and yet it is going to become law anyway. The majority of the majority you fought for got rolled by the Democrats. And there was one particular moment in this bill that got me. It was when Mike Bost, fresh off of his one-point primary election victory, voted yes. And then when it became clear that the bill had all of the votes that it needed to pass. Oh, then he ran down to the clerk and changed his vote to a no vote. So Mike Bost was actually for it, then flipped to be against it when the no vote didn't matter. I wonder if that one-point primary election victory had anything to do with that motivation. But it's deceptive, and it's dishonest, and unfortunately we saw a betrayal of Republican values. There's no other way to describe it from 101 Republicans, 112 of us who voted no, were not enough to stop this bad bill. There's other breaking news on Capitol Hill today. Mike Gallagher just announcing that he will be resigning from the House of Representatives prior to the conclusion of his term. Middle of April, we saw April 19th bouncing around as a date that was being reported by Jake Sherman at Punch Bowl News. And Mike Gallagher is a very smart person. Mike Gallagher is someone who understands the world a great deal. I sat next to him on the House Armed Services Committee for 7 years. He chairs one of the cyber intelligence evolving technologies subcommittees upon which I serve. And it's very disappointing to see him resigning before the end of his term. When we get elected for two-year terms. We're on a two-year contract. I think every member should stay for the 2 years. And I have this view whether I like the person or not. I didn't like Kevin McCarthy. I was disappointed when he left before the conclusion of his term. I like Mike Gallagher. Disappointed that he's leaving before the conclusion of his term. Because to me, it's like a breach of contract with your voters. You signed up for a job. You knew when you signed up for it how long it lasts. And my frustration comes from the fact that we are now at a one seat majority. One. And that puts everything that we could potentially do at grave risk. And it strengthens the hand of those who want to draw us into these bad bills that give away the farm to the Democrats when our majority is reduced, cut by a quarter, cut in half, cut to barely nothing. The other breaking news on Capitol Hill today is that Marjorie Taylor Greene has filed a motion to vacate. When I filed a motion to vacate Kevin McCarthy, it demanded immediate legislative action within a prescribed window. So 2 days after I filed the motion to vacate McCarthy, there was a window that opened, and immediately upon that window opening, I called for a vote. We heard Congresswoman Greene describe her intentions very differently today. Her intention was not to file this and call it up for a vote within 2 days as I did. She's filing it, and I guess for lack of a proper legislative term, she's allowing it to cook. She's allowing it to simmer. She's allowing it to, I guess, be the subject of some discussion and debate. And it's hard not to view these two stories, Gallagher leaving, Greene filing this, in some concert, right? Because whether or not you can execute a motion to vacate the speaker is contingent upon your size of majority at any given moment. And when I vacated McCarthy, I made a promise to all of you, to the entire country, that we would not end up with a Democrat speaker. I knew it. I promised it. And had we ended up with a Democrat speaker, then I would have broken my word to you, and I would have been rightfully drubbed out of this job. As I sit here now with a one-vote majority, with like, I don't know, 10, 12 of our members in Biden districts, am I sure that one, two, three of those people to be the head of the Budget Committee, to be the head of the Appropriations Committee, to be the head of the Intelligence Committee, to be the head of the Rules Committee, to be the floor leader, that one or two of them wouldn't cross over and vote for a Democrat, maybe even Hakeem Jeffries? I'm not sure of that. And because I'm not sure of that, do not count me among those who would support a motion to vacate at this time. And not that there's one that's been called up. To be fair to Congresswoman Greene, I think she understands that dynamic. That's why she is pursuing a different path than I pursued with Kevin McCarthy. But we'll continue to follow up on it. And really, what brought us to this moment where we're even having this discussion, unfortunately, is this omnibus spending bill. And it violates all of the principles that I set forth. And frankly, it violates a lot of the principles that I know Mike Johnson campaigned on when he ran for speaker. And that's why he wants to get to a discussion of 2025 spending to lay out a vision to show those priorities. And a lot of people are smarting and hurting over what we just experienced today. And if there is a sentiment that is just so Washington and so wrong and so vile and so destructive to our economy and our nation, it is the sentiment that you always just have to be for the deal. Some people get deal hungry, deal happy. You know what? We just need a deal. And it doesn't matter if it's a bad deal, good deal, if it increases inflation, if prices go up, if the lobbyists get paid off, just get the deal done. It is so corrosive. And no one expresses that sentiment more than someone who is leaving Congress at the end of his term, but fulfilling his term, North Carolina Congressman and former, I guess, you know, McCarthy wet nurse, Patrick McHenry. Here's Congressman McHenry making this bad argument.
You know, it's been well covered, my constructive criticism of the speaker. And I think I want to emphasize the first part, which is go land the deal. Do not fear the deal. You have to go land those legislative priorities in order to show power and to exercise power. Otherwise, you don't want to be speaker unless you want to go land deals. He has now landed his second big deal as speaker, and he'll land it this week. That should be commended.
Just work for the deal. And I'm going to go over some of the bad stuff that was in that deal, but we've got some comments on the live stream. People want to know who voted which way. And so, Jacob, let's make sure we get the vote sheet from our legislative team and post on our official Facebook and our official X pages so that the people here who want to know where their member of Congress is can see how the vote played out. But It was a vote on so many things that do not have an appropriate federal nexus. Let me just go through some of these earmarks. So New Jersey senators are at $500,000 taxpayer dollars that they got to fund a state organization that force feeds the LGBT agenda in schools. The group, Garden State Equality, assists in finding gender mutilation surgeries for minors. And they harass schools that prevent biological men from using women's bathrooms and participating in women's sports. So that's what $500,000 went to. Massachusetts senators got $1 million in taxpayer funds to support a leadership academy for left-wing political organizations. The Massachusetts Women of Color Coalition that explicitly caters to non-white women. So if you are a man or if you are white, this $1 million in Massachusetts is not for you. And really, it is a beachhead for the Defund the Police movement. A part of what they're advocating for is, quote, use of force statutes and policies, close quote, for police to change. Maryland, getting their nose down in the trough. Their senators want $500,000 in taxpayer dollars for an organization called The Third that provides a safe space for women of color entrepreneurs. I mean, in Maryland, if you need to go create safe spaces for a specific ethnic or immutable trait of entrepreneurs, then do it with your own money. Connecticut senators want $156,000 to subsidize construction of the Hartford Gay and Lesbian Health Collective. Wisconsin senator wanted $500,000 to promote LGBT programs to teenagers. So we're going into debt. We're $34.5 trillion in debt. We're driving $2.5 trillion annual deficits. But Teens Like Us is a program that you are now funding so that there can be trans tape kits provided to minors. That's literally what they do. And Wisconsin's Democrat Senator Tammy Duckworth wanted that. Connecticut senators got $155,000 in taxpayer monies going to an organization called Make the Road CT. Their executive director recently criticized Joe Biden for rightfully calling Lincoln Riley's murder illegal. So the head of this organization criticizes Biden for calling a murderer illegal and a $155,000 windfall as a consequence. This legislation is chock full of this stuff. The top lines are too high. The debt is just blown out, and no one seems to be too eager in taking responsibility for it. One of my terrific colleagues, fellow firebrand Chip Roy, was debating on the floor against this bad legislation. Take a listen.
The Democrat leader talks about the mosaic. I assume by the mosaic that anyone who votes for this bill today will be supporting that we're talking about $156,000 for the Hartford Gay and Lesbian Health Collective, an organization self-described as champions of LGBTQIA equity and provides training and cultural competency and access to health care for LGBTQ youth, or $2 million in Oregon Clinic that provides hormone therapy for kids, or the $850,000 for gay senior housing in Massachusetts, or $400,000 for the Briar Patch Youth Services in Wisconsin that has gender-affirming clothing program for kids 18 to 13 to 18. Or $400,000 to the Garden State Equality Education Fund, which helps minors transition genders, promote biological boys playing girl sports and using the same restrooms. I could go on and on. How about the $1 million for the Inner City Muslim Network, which calls for the destruction of Israel? That's what we're funding. That's precisely what we're funding in this legislation. So when the Democratic leader talks about a mosaic, that's what he's talking about. And my Republican colleagues who will campaign against it all year, they will. They're voting to fund it today. To be very clear, my Republican colleagues are voting to fund that so-called mosaic today, unless they choose the right path and vote against it. And my friend from California, when he talked about, oh, the horrors that'll happen if we have a CR, well, we shouldn't be here. This is the swamp acting what it does. Have government funding expire on the Friday before a two-week recess heading into Easter, precisely to have the pressure of jet fumes so that the American people are the ones left holding the bag, so that we, members of Congress, can go off to our CODELs, can go travel, can go do your fundraisers, can make sure you get home. But the ones left holding the bag are the American people. And when we talk about this, the game was given up. When we talk about defense, everything that is happening here is being done in the name of defense. everything that you see, and talking about how our national security will be undermined. Well, tell me about national security in Texas. When you have the National Guard getting rolled over in El Paso, when you have Texans dying from fentanyl poisoning, when you have gangs and cartels operating in Texas, talk to me about national security then.
That was Congressman Chip Roy. We're back live, and despite that effective and persuasive debate, again, we had over 100 Republicans voting for this bad legislation, and they will have to face their voters, and I think the judgment is going to be very harsh. We have another report from BusinessInsider.com. Ex-Trump official, we'll get to why that's ridiculous in a moment, files suit arguing lawmakers should make more than $174,000 a year. So here's the crux of this argument. The 27th Amendment to the Constitution says, quote, no law varying the compensation for the services of senators and representatives shall take effect until an election of representatives shall have intervened. So this lawsuit filed by Ken Cuccinelli, the former attorney general of the state of Virginia, was on behalf of Republican Congressman Rick Crawford of Arkansas and a trio of ex-lawmakers from both parties. And it says that because the members of Congress have a $174,000 a year salary that hasn't changed, that it has been, quote, unconstitutionally suppressed. They're seeking $50 million in this class action lawsuit. And one of the named plaintiffs is actually, this caught me by surprise, former Republican Representative Tom Davis of Virginia is seeking $268,839 additional dollars. Tom Davis is now a lobbyist for foreign governments. I think he might be like a registered foreign agent or something. But how you can go from being a lawmaker and then you go to using that prior experience to make money from foreign governments to lobby members of Congress, and then the nerve to come back and say that's not a sweet enough deal and you need to get paid back pay, it is legally flawed, and I believe it is morally bankrupt to back this lawsuit. So don't count me among those who want to get to $50 million in back pay for members of Congress. No one needs to be worried about us. We get taken care of just fine compared to the working people who get screwed each and every day, just like Chip Roy was talking about. But outside of the substance of this report, what really got me was that Ken Cuccinelli, the person who is bringing this lawsuit, is described in this big headline as ex-Trump official. Ken Cuccinelli was the chairman of Never Back Down, Ron DeSantis' super PAC. Why wasn't he described as, I don't know, the guy who formerly led a super PAC attacking Donald Trump? Just to give you a flavor of it and spare me the throwback. But I guest hosted a Newsmax program some months ago when the presidential contest was still raging between Trump and DeSantis. And I had Cuccinelli on to have a debate, right, where I was the pro-Trump person and he was the pro-DeSantis person. So just like take a listen to that and think about whether or not it's fair for the media to describe him as an ex-Trump official. Take a listen.
Can you commit tonight that none of the money from the Never Back Down Super PAC will be flipped to support the candidacy of Glenn Youngkin in the event that you guys don't see DeSantis as a
Matt,
good bet?
You know, they didn't tell me they were bringing me on for your conspiracy theories. Look, this PAC is committed
That's
to
a fair question. Are you going to use the money that way?
No, it's not really. I mean, not with your 12 degrees of Kevin Bacon. This, we're committed.
Well, wait a second. Ron, you have the total control to be able to direct that money. Question. You don't think it's a fair question to ask you where it's
we're
going?
Committed. I'm answering it, aren't I? So it really doesn't matter if it's fair.
Again, any connection that they can make to Trump for any negative headline, they take an absurd license to do so. So we don't back the lawsuit. We don't back the characterization of the tie to Trump. I don't think anyone associated with President Trump believes that what we really need to do is create more of a golden parachute for members of Congress. Another story I want to bring to you is the wave of illegal immigration that continues to pound our country and particularly the Sunshine State. St. Lucie County is a small county in Florida. It's a coastal county that is right there on Highway 95 and also is on the Atlantic Ocean. And they are even experiencing some pretty some pretty odd circumstances. This report from St. Lucie County and their terrific law enforcement officials, their sheriff, take a listen.
I'm St. Lucie County Sheriff Keith Pearson. Illegal aliens aren't just flooding across our southern borders. They're arriving all across South Florida beaches, including right here in St. Lucie County. They are undocumented and unvetted individuals whom we have no idea what type of positive or negative impact they could have on public safety of our community or nation. Working with immigration to enforce the law of the land, our deputies helped with this interception. After making sure there were no immediate medical needs, we provided fresh water while they wait to be picked up from the United States Coast Guard and processed. Behind me, you see a vessel loaded with the migrants that we're talking about. The men and women of the St. Lucie County Sheriff's Office will continue to monitor and assist our federal partners to ensure we protect our borders.
And we are proud of the men and women of the St. Lucie Sheriff's Office for doing this. But frankly, there should be a force multiplier from the federal government. We know we are facing a mass wave of these Haitian migrants. And if Joe Biden would declare the anticipated mass maritime migration, we would have support for folks like those brave public servants that are working for the St. Lucie County Sheriff's Office. Again, we thank you, we salute you, and the federal government should be doing a lot more to have your back. And really, this immigration crisis takes so many twists and turns and has so many tentacles. I wanted to just bring you an interesting perspective on like how bad it's gotten. And we get this story from the terrific team at WEAR in Pensacola, but the illegal immigration and the phony asylum process has gotten so bad, it's created a cottage industry of fraud feasers who go and act as if they are the government or a lawyer or helping you to like make your asylum claim when you come to the country illegally. And then they end up grifting the illegal aliens. So in this story, you have a Honduran man living in Pensacola, and he used a massive immigration scheme to make $2.8 million. This from the WEAR report. A Honduran national living in Pensacola has been sentenced to 9 years in federal prison for orchestrating a massive immigration fraud scheme involving over 425 victims nationwide. Franklin Javier Perez Rios, age 29, orchestrated a fraud scheme from 2017 to 2023 in which he claimed to be able to provide immigration-related services to foreign nationals living in the United States. He profited at least $2.8 million from victims, according to the district attorney's office, which he used for gambling and to fund a lavish lifestyle. Perez Rios, who had no legitimate qualifications, pretended at various times to be a United States government official, a former United States government official, an immigration attorney, a paralegal, or an immigration services personnel of some other means. Perez Rios did not obtain status for any of the victims he promised. Rather, he routinely filed asylum paperwork with USCIS on the victims' behalf and told them they had to travel to California with him where they would be subjected to medical examinations and vaccinations. Neither the medical examinations nor the trips to California were legitimately part of the asylum process. For other victims, Perez Rios filed no paperwork on their behalf, and to keep victims believing he was working on their behalf, Perez Rios provided them with forged documentation supposedly from the United States government. Again, it's gotten so bad that you've created a cottage industry of fraudsters to go after the illegal aliens. I never thought we'd be at this point, but nonetheless, that's where we are. We had big testimony from General Mark Milley on the Hill this week regarding the botched withdrawal from Afghanistan. And one thing I found interesting, like, you can always count on Mark Milley to throw somebody under the bus, right? I mean, he took every occasion to throw Trump under the bus, and now they're even throwing the Department of State under the bus regarding the Afghanistan withdrawal. A lot of shade being thrown at the Biden White House. See if you can read them between the lines. Take a listen.
Number of Americans. This was always an issue. The number of Americans, as General McKenzie said, an F-77 report is supposed to, every ambassador in every country of the world keeps an F-77 report, and they're supposed to track the Americans, where they're at, the phone numbers, address, et cetera, in the country. That was always a difficult number for us in the Department of Defense to get a hold of, and I think it's true at the tactical level and operational level as well. And I'll be candid. I don't know the exact number of Americans that were left behind because the starting number was never clear. Same is true of at-risk Afghans, SIVs, the commandos, other Afghans that serve with us. Those numbers varied so widely that they were quite inaccurate, as best I could tell at the time. So I would just say I'm not sure, even today, about the accuracy of all those numbers.
I think the call to execute the NEO came too late. And as General McKenzie mentioned, it was officially logged in on the 14th. At that point in time, the Afghan government senior leadership was preparing to depart, and they departed the next day on the 15th. Thousands of Afghan civilians were gathering at the airport. The Afghan security forces were collapsing in the various provincial capitals, and although there were some still in and around Kabul. So the general situation at that point was 750 U.S. soldiers in and around the embassy. The Turkish troops were required, along with some ANSF, to protect Hkaya. They melted away. So you had a situation with the U.S. Embassy and 750 troops when that NEO was called. And now we had leaned forward. So I think it's the 9th, 10th, or 11th time frame. We had already put forces on alert, et cetera. But in essence, we alerted, marshaled, deployed 82nd Airborne Division, Division Ready Brigade, and the MU out of Saudi that was underneath General McKenzie's control. They rapidly deployed along with special forces to take control of that airport. It took two to three days. That's where those videos come from. But they eventually wrested control of that airport.
And General McKenzie, you agree with that assessment?
I do. That reflects the opinion I had at the time and the opinion I had now.
Yeah, I believe the accountability ensures mistakes of the past are not repeated. But from where I sit, President and this administration refuse to acknowledge their failures. Our investigation uncovered the White House refused to listen to warnings about the situation on the ground. Disturbingly, we have uncovered that State Department leadership prohibited its employees from even uttering the word NEO, shorthand for emergency evacuation, until as late as August of 2021. Too little, too late.
We are back live. Deanna on Facebook says, make accountability great again, indeed. And Joe on YouTube asks, why does he look so bloated? Joe, help us out. Were you talking about me or Millie? Because, frankly, he looks bloated, and I feel a little bloated myself. This week, we also had a chance in the House Armed Services Committee to discuss what is really going on with Taiwan. And with a country so capable as China, with their ambition set on Taiwan, what are the things we're actually doing to try to deter that potential invasion so that we don't get caught in some war in Asia? I had the opportunity to ask some of the top military leaders about our Indo-Pacific strategy. Take a listen. Admiral Aquilino, you know, during the Revolutionary War, I think it was like 15% of Americans who fought for liberty. Does that sound about right? 15-20%?
I couldn't answer that now, Congressman. I have to go back and look.
I guess I'm just kind of wondering, in Taiwan, what percent of the Taiwanese do we assess would actually fight in the event of kinetic conflict with China?
Yeah, I also don't have that calculation. What I can tell you is when the Russians invaded Ukraine, that was a pretty good wake-up signal for a lot of people across the globe, and especially for those people on Taiwan. And we continue to execute our responsibilities under the Taiwan Relations Act to ensure we support their ability to defend themselves.
And does that act require the development of a home guard in Taiwan?
I'd have to go back and look at the law. I don't specifically know if that...
I don't think it does, but maybe you could talk a little bit about what the home guard theory is in Taiwan, how that would enhance their capabilities.
Well, again, it's what the people on Taiwan have done is they do have a reserve activation program. President Tsai just extended that to a one-year commitment. So, again, when I talk about the people on Taiwan taking it seriously... they are. It includes that approach that you've just articulated.
Yeah, and I almost think that's what it's going to take, because I worry that the Taiwanese military may be infiltrated by the PLA, and that if there's really going to be a deterrent from a Chinese invasion, that might not come exclusively from the uniformed military or even the reservists. We may have to actually, render capability to the hundreds of thousands of Taiwanese who don't want to be part of China, right?
Yeah, your point is valid. And again, I believe that approach is and actions are being taken there. What I would say is the best example that I think exists is when Israel was attacked by the violent extremists in Hamas, The next day, 360,000 Israelis reported for duty. That's the type of response that I believe.
Yeah, but I worry that we conflate the cultural features there, right? Because what I worry about in Taiwan is kind of a replay of Afghanistan, where we look at some fake government and we do the normal kind of DOD thing of large weapon systems, and then we give them to that government, and then the real governing power, in Afghanistan's case, the Taliban, in Taiwan's case, perhaps China, has the ability to then repurpose those assets against the United States. So it just seems to me, I mean, you are the guy, you're the person in charge of this theater. I think you need to know, you need to have some sort of assessment as to whether or not you're going to get that Israel-level response from the Taiwanese. You know, what percentage of this group of people is going to stand up and fight? And sure, we're all continuously informed by events going on around the world. But in Taiwan specifically, like, we've seen cases where the PLA is infiltrating their government, their military. And I don't offer that as some sort of criticism. Heck, I think they try to infiltrate our government and our military too. But I worry whether or not we're going to be able to rely on the uniformed service there. So is there a plan at DOD to kind of make these assessments about a home guard and to ensure that you have small arms in the hands of these people that might deter a Chinese invasion?
Congressman, there absolutely is, and I'd love to talk to you about it in a classified setting.
Great. No, it's good to know. And is that consistent with this porcupine theory that we think about often with Taiwan?
I don't use the term porcupine theory. A lot of people do.
Why don't you use it? I hear it a lot on this committee.
Well, again, I would articulate it in a way that is in alignment with the law, which is we're providing the people on Taiwan the ability, capability, and training to be able to defend themselves in time of conflict. That by itself, with regard to a strong Taiwan sets of capabilities, is a strong deterrent.
Yeah, I just think this is a real important piece of the homework to emanate from this is to, you've talked about the Taiwan Security Engagement Act. I get that. But I think you and I are both a little unclear as to the extent to which that authorizes the work with the Home Guard that we really need to convert Taiwan into an effective porcupine, because I assess that this is all about time. China cannot endure an extended war with Taiwan. They can't endure the sanctions. They can't endure the other consequences. And so if we can demonstrate to them that that's going to be a longer period of time, I think that pushes out the inevitability of a kinetic conflict with China. So appreciate the exchange, Mr. Chairman. I yield back. And we are back live. There's a MTG for speaker sentiment on the live chat. Man, wouldn't that be something? I would be here for the MTG for speaker experience, no doubt. PK on YouTube asks, how can I work with the 101 Republicans who voted for this bad bill? And honestly, it's not that easy. And they, for whatever dislike I have for that vote, they probably have plenty of dislike directed back at me. But the difference is, when I do things that folks don't like in Washington, they don't like it because it makes them uncomfortable. It disrupts their fundraising and their progression to power and leadership. And when the establishment does things that I don't like, it's not like to me, it's to the country. It's to every person paying higher prices. It's to the next generation of Americans that will be saddled with an unprecedented amount of debt because we're unwilling to confront the challenges that face us. So we're going to stay on it. This next 2 weeks is going to be very critical. I'm going to be traveling around the country doing a lot of work with policymakers, with thought leaders, and doing some stuff that I can't exactly talk about on this platform. But it's going to be important work. It's going to be central to how we get a House of Representatives that is actually willing to fight for we the people. So since I'm going to be not giving direct live reports on Firebrand for a little bit of time here coming up, we are trying out something new. The Gates News Network will launch moments after the conclusion of this broadcast. You'll be able to see it on our Twitter, or X, I guess now, on Rumble, and on YouTube. And this is going to be a 24-hour stream of some of the work we've done on investigations, some of the work we've done on the floor of the Congress, some of the committee work that's been essential to getting people into a fighting posture, and also some of the reports that we've been able to provide the country through Firebrand on things like critical race theory, DEI, on the illegal immigration that's crushing our nation. So we hope you'll enjoy that. We hope it will deepen your understanding of what we need to do to change the United States Congress. So tune in and share the live stream on whatever platform you're using, the Gates News Network. If you're picking up this report on one of our great audio platforms, make sure to go to Rumble, YouTube, or X and watch all the work we're doing, and hopefully it'll make you an even more capable operative in the fight as we work on saving the country together. Thanks so much. Roll the credits.